they just motivated me to keep going and not give up. And I always say that persistence is the difference between those that make it and those that don't, because you don't have to be great at something, you don't have to be perfect, and you don't have to be the best. You just have to keep going. And because everyone else will drop out, you'll end up being the best person there because you'll be the last one there. or you'll just get so good at it. So there was a lot of times that I had to dig really, really deep to find motivation, and there are other times that I was just breezing along because it was so sweet and lovely.
That was Laura Bingham talking about cycling across South America, and this is the All Things Risk podcast. Welcome, and welcome back, everyone. My name is Ben Cattaneo. I'm your host. This is my show. This is the All Things Risk podcast. It's a side project, a passion project for me. And what I do around here is I have long-form conversations with who I consider to be fascinating people. And I use the lenses of risk, resilience, randomness, uncertainty to explore all kinds of topics. My conversations with my guests, I hope, inspire, inform, and entertain you. I hope that they give you ideas, and even if they influence you only in very subtle ways, that really makes me happy. The show is free of charge. It always will be. The only thing that I ask is that if you enjoy the show, if you enjoy a particular episode, well, guess what? Chances are others probably would enjoy it too. So all I ask is that you share the show, you provide perhaps a review or a rating, particularly on iTunes, as it helps get the show noticed. I'm very thankful for you joining me here today. I hope that you're enjoying your summer if you're in the Northern Hemisphere, and even if you're not, if you're in the Southern Hemisphere or you're not enjoying your summer or both, don't worry, because I hope that you enjoy this next hour or so. I think you'll find it to be a very interesting conversation and lots of fun. There's a bit of a cycling theme throughout today's show for a number of reasons. Number one, the Tour de France just finished. I enjoy watching the Tour de France. So I'm having a few withdrawal symptoms, but there's another race that's about to start this weekend. And I wanted to give a shout out to my friend and a former guest on this show, Marcin Chuana. Check out episode 2. Marcin is about to ride the Transcontinental Race. The Transcontinental Race is this awesome, slightly crazy, actually very crazy, ultra-endurance cycling race that takes riders from Belgium across 4 checkpoints dotted throughout Europe. Now, these aren't any ordinary checkpoints. They're typically in the high Alps or in the Balkans or in very gnarly, difficult places. And it goes all the way through to Istanbul. So about 4,000 to 4,500 kilometers. So it's pretty epic stuff. Marcin is number 101 in this year's TCR, and that sounds like a lucky number to me. And that starts this weekend, and I wanted to wish him all the best. And I hope that he has a great race and he does very well. Check out episode 2. That's my conversation with him. You don't have to be a cycling enthusiast to get a lot out of the episode. I think you'll find it very interesting. And I think that's the same for today's episode. We talk cycling today, but again, you don't have to be a cycling enthusiast or fanatic or know very much about it to get loads of great stuff out of my guest today, who is Laura Bingham. Laura is an adventurer. She has a very interesting background. She's worked in a number of fields. She was a model. She was an English teacher in Mexico. And on her way back from Mexico to her native England, she decided that, hey, I think I'll sail across the Atlantic, which she did. And very recently, she completed an epic cycling journey across South America. She cycled from Ecuador through to Peru, Bolivia, Paraguay and Argentina into Buenos Aires, which incidentally is the town where I was born. It was a massive distance. It was pretty grueling. Obviously, you've got the Andes, you've got the Amazon, you've got the desert in Bolivia. So yeah, it was. But there's a little twist here. She did all of this on no money. What? Yeah, that's right. No money. Along the way, she had to find ingenious ways to get food. So that might have been things like volunteering on farms, asking strangers for help, that kind of thing. Very interesting indeed. And she did this in aid of a charity called Operation South America that feeds and nurtures children from poor families. And you'll hear in our conversation that all of this obviously very profoundly affected how she looks at the world, how she looks at things like poverty, and we get into all of that. It is a fabulous conversation. We talk about her background, where this whole idea of cycling with no money came from, how it worked, what were the logistics of it, the mechanics of it, how she went about finding food in different places, how she went about pitching her tent and finding a place to sleep, all of that kind of stuff, the tough times that she experienced along the way, mental strength. We have a wonderful conversation about that, highlights of the adventure, and advice to anyone considering doing something special, whether or not that's cycling or adventure related or anything else. Some really good advice and a whole lot more. It's a great conversation. As I said, I think you're going to really enjoy it. Ladies and gentlemen, here is Laura Bingham.
But you've got back a few days ago. I've been overseas for long durations. I've never done anything like what you've done. Okay. I'm a cyclist, but I'm not a cyclist like you. You've been a cyclist. But just coming back from something like this, how do you feel right now? You just come back and...
It's funny when you say like that you're a cyclist, but then like I'm a cyclist because I'd never really cycled before this. I'd never done like tours or competitions. I knew how to ride a bike, but that was as big as my knowledge went. I did a few sort of 100-mile trips around England in camp, sort of cycled camp, but I'd say maybe now I'm more of a cyclist because of the whole trip, but I would never, I still don't really call yourself.
Well, Laura, you are. And welcome to the show. Just really great to have you. And normally, I haven't had a guest who's just done something like really epic like what you've done, and it just completed it a few days ago. I've had people who've come on and done some amazing things, but a little bit further removed. But so you've just cycled across South America.
Yeah.
No money. So we'll get into all of that. But what on earth possessed you to do that? Where did that idea come from?
When I was 18, I started traveling. And little by little, they just got bigger and a bit crazier until I was living in Mexico teaching English and doing a bit of jaguar conservation for the government. And then I didn't really have enough money to fly home. So I thought, how else am I going to get home? Let's think inventive now. And I found a ship with two guys and a cat. And I thought, right, let's get on this this ship. Like, let's get on this trimaran and learn how to sail, because I'd never sailed before. I'd never met these men before. I just got on a boat and sailed back to England. And then when I got back to England, everyone was like, oh my God, I can't believe you just did that. And I was like, I just got on a boat and learned how to tie some ropes. But the reaction I got was such like a little adrenaline thing that I was like, oh, if I do something else crazier, I might get a bigger reaction. So then when I got back to England, obviously that inevitable question pops into one's head. Yeah, what do I do now? Mm-hmm. So I've got this bucket list, and my life revolves around this bucket list. Mm-hmm. It's got 87 points on it. And one of them was cycling across the country. Okay. So I was like, why don't I just cycle around the world and try and hold the record for that? Like, there was a guy that did it in 3 months. So
Angus Beaumont? Mark.
There's another lady called Julietta something. Okay. And she did it in 3 months and he did it in 2 months. Mm-hmm. And I thought, I can do it in like 3 months, mm-hmm. less than 3 months. But then the more I started thinking about it, the more I realized that I was more about the journey and not the race. Mm-hmm. And I prefer like really immersing myself in cultures. And I realized that cycling around the world couldn't accomplish that. So I honed in on South America. And because I already knew how to speak Spanish, that seemed like the best place to go. And I just absolutely adore the South American, Central American culture. And I know how generous and how loving they are as a nation. Mm-hmm. So I went for South America and I thought, okay, well, how do I make this different? Because I just have to be a little madam and I have to be like special. So I was like, right, okay, how about I do it without any money? And then I started looking at different charities and stuff. And I found this charity called Operation South America that look at feeding and giving shelter to young girls. They look after 21 young girls. So I thought that was amazing and I could do it for them. And it all just tied in really perfectly. Yes. And it just felt really right to do it. Up until about 2 weeks into the expedition, and then I was like, "This doesn't feel right at all."
We'll get into all that. I did want to explore your background a little bit.
Yeah.
So, what brought you to Mexico? Why did you decide to go to Mexico?
Because originally I started traveling because my parents got divorced, and like all of these bad things happened within my family, and then I started going down a really bad path. That I knew wasn't healthy. So then I decided that I'd go traveling instead and to try and find myself and to try and find a life that I loved to the point that I'd want to stay in, that gave me the happiness that I was missing in my life. So then I went and lived in Greece and then Belgium and then South Africa, and then I went back to England and then Indonesia and traveled all over. And then I ended up finding myself working in polo and jumping in Florida.
Okay.
And I'd met a chap from Mexico, and he said, come to Mexico and do your TEFL course and teach English. Mm-hmm. And I thought, why not? Mm-hmm. So I did my TEFL course in the States, and then just got a flight down to Mexico. And within 3 days, I'd found a job and a place to live, and lived there for about 4 months. And then you finished,
and then you decided to sail back. Okay. Let's go back to this cycling with no money. Okay, so going, you know, cycling internationally and across countries is, you know, tough as it is.
Yeah.
You spoke some of the language. Mm-hmm. The no money part is interesting.
Yeah,
and that adds an extra dimension for a number of reasons. I can think of. I mean, for one, you know, you need to do these kinds of things. You need to fuel yourself properly. You need to rest properly. If you don't get the right sorts of nutrition, then you know, the next day is going to be awful, or could be. The no money part adds, you know, a huge. You know, if you, yeah, just take me through that, because that part really.
It was funny because I had an original partner, Cho, and then I had my fiancé come with me, and then I had an adventuress called Ness Knight that came that did 2 weeks with me, and she did a cycling tour across the US.
Okay.
And so she came into my expedition, and obviously if you come into someone's expedition or their adventure, you do as they do. So she lived without money with me for like 2 weeks, and there was one particular day that we pushed ourselves, and we did like 130 kilometers that day, and to get to Oruro in Bolivia. And she was like, I'm so scared. And she was like, it's gonna be dark by the time we get there, and we can't just book into our hotel. And I said, I know, we just have to ask at churches and find a safe place to sleep before something bad happens. And she was like, but we can't just find a hotel. We have to find someone that's willing to help us. And I was like, welcome to my life. For 3 months. And she was like, this is terrifying. And it was really interesting to have her come along and talk to me about the difference between cycling with money and cycling without money. One of the most annoying things about having to cycle without money was the fact that whatever food I found, I would have to carry. Like, I would, like, whenever there was food in front of me, I'd just shove my face full of food, and I became a little bit of a porker in Peru because Ecuador was so hard, and I was so hungry for so long. I just gorged in Peru and, like, plumped out. And then whenever I found food on the side of the road, or people were willing to give me rice or pasta, or I'd stay with people and help on their farm, then they'd give me some rice to take away. I would carry it. And normally if like a person's doing a cycling tour, they'll carry enough food for that day, and then maybe two days spare of food or something, just in case they can't find a place with food. Whereas I was carrying two panniers full of food at one point. So that was a lot of extra weight
that
I didn't need.
Yeah, absolutely.
Because I was so scared that if I didn't have that food, someone like wouldn't give me food in the evening and I'd be hungry. And there was a lot of fear involved. And a lot of fear revolving around not having money. So I couldn't just buy a hotel if I got to a city and I couldn't find anywhere. I couldn't just buy the food that I wanted. I now have a bit of an issue with supermarkets. Every time I go into supermarkets, I start crying.
Oh, wow.
I got back from the airport and me and my fiance went to Waitrose and I picked up a bag of carrots and started crying.
Really?
I had to like look at the bacon for an extended period of time until I stopped, put it in the trolley, and I went and picked up yogurts and started crying again. And I was like, you're just going to have to shop and I'm just going to stand here because I can't take it.
Wow.
I did though. I went into Asda or something yesterday and I was like, I just need milk. So I ran in, grabbed the milk and like ran out before I started crying.
Wow. Wow. Where did the idea come from though? No money. How did you...
I just wanted to be different.
Okay.
I just wanted to make the cycling trip slightly harder, slightly different.
Okay.
And then I found this charity and I really wanted to understand what it was like for these girls because a lot of them, their parents don't have enough money to look after them, so that's why they're there, or their parents are violent, or they don't have any parents and they were living on the street. And there's so many homeless people around, and I've got this thing that I want to know everything and I want to try everything, and I wanted to know what it felt like for those people. And obviously I had the comfort of knowing that I had a home to go back to and I had money waiting for me at the end, and there was a finishing line.
Sure.
So I had that blessing to keep me going, and I know that those people out there, they don't have that one blessing that I found comfort in. So what is that?
We've got people coming and going.
Oh,
It adds a little bit to the authentic vibe of the show.
And I wanted to understand or have like a slight shed of light of how they lived. And it's not easy.
I can imagine that it can't be easy at all. Mm-hmm. So you started out in Ecuador.
Yeah.
And then all the way through to Argentina. And so again, you know, you're not just cycling, but you're going through the Andes.
Yeah, I went through them three times. I started off in Manta in Ecuador on the coast. And then I went over the Andes to get to the Amazon in Peru. So those Ecuadorian Andes were tough. There aren't that many tarmac roads. They're all dirt roads with inches of mud.
Right.
We had to like pull the bikes through and push them through.
So what was the sort of the setup? I just want to talk a bit about your equipment. I'm going to geek out a little bit because I'm a cyclist, but you know, my setup, I have a bike that's like, you know, weighs 7 kilos and, you know, a carbon fiber frame and all this stuff. But you've got roads that aren't tarmacked. I'm sure you've got bigger wheels. You're carrying all this stuff with you. What are you lugging around when you're going through the Andes?
So going through the Andes, I had to have I had a Genesis Croxter Fur 30.
Okay.
So it's like a hybrid, a touring bike. So it's not like a fat bike with huge wheels, and it's not a road bike.
But it get you through the gravel and the different.
Yeah, it
types
didn't get me through the sand. I had to pull the bike through the sand. Thank you, Bolivia. But it served me very, very well.
Okay.
One of them got hit by a minivan and got run over, and then it got hit by a truck. So the people that were on the bike are fine, but the bike got smashed the first time and got welded back together and bent back together. So this
while you were riding it, while someone was riding it,
they fell off, and then a car came, knocked that person out of the way, and then ran over the bike. So the bike got. Like, Madison wanted to use it in exhibitions now because it got bent and broken, welded back together, and then still did another 4,000 kilometers.
Where was this?
This happened when we were going over the Andes the second time.
Okay.
But going the second time from the Amazon basin to the coast in Lima, that was lovely. That was lovely because it was pure tarmac and it was such a smooth incline and such a smooth descent. It was amazing. But on the descent, about 60 kilometers out of Lima, it was raining, and we were really, really trying to push to get to Lima before sundown, because we I had a contact there waiting for me, so I knew there was a bed and a shower, so we were pushing it. And my cycling partner, Cherry, just came a bit too close to me and then had to swerve and then went into a little pothole, fell off.
Ouch.
And this truck came and ran over the bike.
Ouch.
And then the second time, my fiancé got knocked off the bike.
Ouch.
By a truck.
Yeah.
So
pretty hairy.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, take me through. So Ecuador. So your first few. I think I read something where that was kind of tough for you, those first few days. So take me through like a typical day. You're doing several kilometers.
Yeah.
The sun starts to go down, and now what? What do you do? What's the protocol?
So within Ecuador, it was because my legs didn't have the muscle that they do now. It was, I had to push the
bike. Imagine that.
Yeah. They're good and strong now.
Mm-hmm. So did you do any training beforehand?
Just
got on the bike and started to go. Okay.
No, yeah,
fair enough. Okay.
I'd say I did more mental training about myself.
Sure. Well,
because
probably more important.
The body can endure pretty much anything. It's the mind you have to convince.
Mm-hmm.
So a typical day in Ecuador in the Andes, because it was their sort of rainy period, I spent a lot of days very wet and cold because like that type of altitude, it's very cold.
Mm-hmm.
So there's one specific day that I remember, which is probably the worst day of the whole expedition. And we'd been pushing these bikes and all of this too much gear up the Andes for about 4 or 5 days. Just solidly pushing the bikes up, and it was raining, and I was cold, and I was hungry, and I didn't have anything left in me, and I dropped the bikes down, and I fell to my knees, and I was crying, and the Cho that was cycling with me walked across the road and asked this lady in the garden if she could help us or let us camp in her garden, and she just looked at me and shook her finger, so I could clearly see, there's nothing I could have done. I just got picked up the bike just carried on pushing it, crying, until we found somewhere that we could camp.
So it's just a question of finding a spot where you can pitch your tent and get some sleep.
Yeah, and in that kind of situation, I always would think, well, if I had money, would I be able to just buy food off her and just say, can I just buy some vegetables?
Uh-huh.
And
because
she might have been more open to selling rather than just giving.
I guess that's an interesting, an interesting parallel. The people that, for example, that you were helping through the charity, I'm sure that happens a lot, and not just on a bicycle expedition, but on a daily occurrence.
There was, and there's one moment that I realized that this expedition didn't give me the real knowledge that I was looking for, or it didn't represent the truth as much as when I was in Ecuador as well, and there was someone that took us in and helped us, and he dropped us off at his house, and then we went into his car, so he was showing us around the city, and we went to this viewpoint, and he was like, this is that, and he had just bought us like a little mini burger type thing and a drink, and this poor person, this person that lived on the streets, came up and said, oh, do you have any spare change? And he was like, no, I don't, sorry, go away. And I was like, I know you've got spare change. I've just seen you put that change in your pocket. And I was like, okay, so because I'm an interest piece, that's maybe why some people are helping me more than they would help a dirty person. Mm. Or like someone that's actually on the street. So that saddened me a bit, but there are still plenty of other times that I was crying on the side of the streets because no one would help me, or I didn't have anywhere to go, and I was hungry. And
so how would you get food? You mentioned that you would help people and you'd get something in return, some rice or some potatoes or something like that. I did see a video where you were I think it was rummaging through
Oranges?
Yes, that's right.
Nests?
Yes, I think so. Yeah. So what are the different ways that you've got food for yourself?
Okay. Well, actually, I also watched a YouTube video of another chap cycling through like Scandinavia or something, and he ate meat so much, and he was like eating loads of meat, and I was like, that does not happen. I was like, you do not find meat. So some of the ways that I'd find food in Ecuador, a lot of it would be going to people's houses, the few people that did welcome us in, and I had to
just
work
asking
on
people to to welcome you in and help you. And
yeah, some of them took pity me being soaked through and not being able to feel my fingers from the cold. And then I'd offer, I'd say, you know, do you want me to, I'd say like, yeah, come in, you can sleep here. And then I'd say, okay, do you want me to help on the farm? Or do you want me to help doing this? And then I'd help for free, obviously. I would never, but I didn't touch money. After Lima, I didn't touch money at all. And then, so sometimes they would then give me food for the road as well.
Sure.
Or when I got to Peru and people started becoming a lot more generous, I'd go into restaurants and ask the restaurants for any
leftovers,
spare food.
And
they'd usually just bring me a full normal plate of food, one that they'd serve to their customers. Or I'd go into shops, like local shops, and ask them for bread or rice or, you know, anything cheap. And then they would, a lot of them would give me something.
Okay.
And then throughout Peru, because Ecuador was so, I want to say traumatizing.
Ecuador was tough.
Ecuador was a lot tougher throughout Peru because they were more generous. I'd just start hoarding food and start collecting it because I was so scared that Bolivia would be the same. I'd heard bad things about Bolivia.
Right.
So I was really scared that that would be the same as Ecuador. But it really, really wasn't. So then in Ecuador, it started to change. In Peru, people weren't as smiley. They were very generous, but they weren't as smiley as people in
Ecuador,
Peru, as people in Paraguay or Argentina.
Okay.
In Bolivia, people became a lot more happier, a lot more smilier, and there were more prominent people that stuck out that would be give me like more than enough for the next like week. And then Paraguay was even more that way. Like, there were so many people, like, waving and really, really happy to see me and give me little toot-toots instead of, like, get out the way toots. And loads of people that would just keep trying to give me food. And I'd be like, no, honestly, I can't carry any more food.
Wow.
And it was the same in Argentina. People were just trying to give me, like, enough food to last me for the whole expedition. And it became a really lovely expedition in the end, but Ecuador took away my sunshine, because I always say that I have like a little sunshine inside me, and Ecuador unfortunately took it away.
Do you think that that was something to do with just getting used to your new environment and maybe the attitude that you might have conveyed? You probably were a lot more scared at the beginning than perhaps you were towards the end, and that might affect how people respond to you. I'm speculating.
But very, very possibly that thought has crossed my mind before, and especially because the partner that I was cycling with originally was a Spanish-speaking person, so I didn't even have the ability to speak my own language with my own type of person.
Right.
And when I had my fiancé come, and I could speak English to him and
maybe
have like
relax
a funny
a
little
bit
conversation and make jokes and stuff, I felt like I wasn't alone, whereas before I felt like I was really alone, so that changed it. I would have said Ecuador, maybe pushing aside people not welcoming me in as much, I would have said mainly because of the weather, the rain and the cold. That was very, very difficult, and not being able to speak English at all.
Sure. So, I mean, cycling in the rain, no matter where you are, is miserable anyway.
Miserable, yeah.
But when you add all of the things that you were you were adding, I can imagine that.
When my two sisters came in, they were both with me. One was with me for a month, and one was with me for 3 weeks. Mm-hmm. And they took about a week adjustment period to adjust into the expedition. Whereas I took, if you look at it from that adjustment period perspective, I took about 2 months to adjust into.
Right. So were you alone at any point, or did you have different people join you at different spots? So how did that work? Did you?
It was supposed to be the first chap that was supposed to accompany me for the entire thing, but after sort of 2 months, there was a cultural difference, man, woman, and it just it didn't work, and we weren't getting on. So we made the decision to go separate ways and for him to go back home, and I was going to finish off the expedition alone. But then after about 2 weeks, I'd cycled through the desert and got to the beach and realised that it wasn't very safe for a woman to be travelling on her own.
Okay.
I got a lot more unwanted attention than I would have liked. So after that, I realised that it wasn't the safest option to travel alone as a female. And then that's when my fiancé came out and accompanied me. And then I then figured out this rota of the friend coming, and then my sister, and then my other sister before I could finish.
Okay, so you had people with you throughout the journey from that point, that point forward.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, interesting. How did they take the first few days of, you know, you described one example, but you know, your world of no food, and you know, it was probably really strange for them, and that you probably showed them how it's done. This is how we do it.
My fiance, he doesn't like imposing on anyone, especially. Mm. So it was really difficult for him. Mm. And then he realized how hard it is for people that have to beg and ask. So he specifically told me, he was like, my view has changed a lot on these people, and I've realized how hard it is for them, because he did not enjoy it one bit. Mm-hmm. But thankfully, because he speaks Spanish, we could approach people as well and work as a team. But the next three female partners, they didn't speak Spanish. Mm-hmm. So it was all down to me. And it was sort of, I felt like I had to care for them a bit more and get the food in for them. So they just had to cycle with me, and I'd deal with the food and the no money side of it. Mm-hmm. It's still annoying for them because they couldn't go to the shop and buy all the treats and sweets and stuff that they would like. Yes. They had to eat crummy rice 24/7 or pasta. So, but they all did really, really well and adjusted within their own time period.
Great. So Peru, you went through Bolivia and then
Paraguay
and then down to Argentina.
And you
said the trip really started to open up for you. So could you talk about some of the highlights, some of the things that you'll take away, you'll never forget?
Paraguay, being at the children's organization, that was amazing. Hmm. They're all so happy and so wonderful, delightful young girls. But it's only when the child defense lawyer drives into the organization that you go, oh yeah, this isn't an after-school club. This isn't like just a club for children to come and play at. They're actually here for a reason, and for a very good reason. So it was a highlight to see these girls and to play with them and play games. And also, there was a lovely German community in Paraguay. They left Russia. They moved out of Russia because they weren't allowed to speak German, teach German in their schools, and they weren't allowed to practice their religion there. And then they moved to Canada, and the same thing happened there. And then they moved to Paraguay, and they've been there almost for 100 years now. Mm-hmm. So it's a very recent thing. They're called Mennonite Christians, and they're such lovely people. Such lovely people.
There are a whole range of these communities of Europeans, pockets of which are in South America, which is bizarre.
So weird. Like cycling through all of these not shanty towns but very, very poor regions, and then suddenly finding yourself in this like virtually westernized area, that, and you're like, am I in Europe or am I in South America? I'm not quite sure. But it's very bizarre how they're from Russia, then they move to Canada, and then they come here, and then they've created this. And it's like, well, how come they've created it and the other people haven't? So there's a real interesting anthropological...
Absolutely, it's fascinating stuff. I mean, the world's largest population of Welsh speakers outside of Wales is in Argentina, for example. You know, it's just weird. You've got Japanese villages in Brazil that are like completely just Japanese villages, and just
it's
dotted
so
throughout the continent. It's really interesting.
But yeah, so then I cycled through the Andes 3 times and then going into Bolivia, cycling the Salar de Uyuni, so the salt plains.
Yes, yes.
Salt plains and sort of any type of terrain that you can think of, I cycled through. And the desert is my least favorite.
Yeah, what was that like?
So scary, because like in the rainforest, I loved it. Loads of mosquitoes, unfortunately. Mm. But there's so much water and vegetation and fruit around. Mm. There's so much life, it's so reassuring. But in the desert, there's no water, there's no life, there's nothing.
Yeah.
So it's so scary, because there was a point that I almost ran out of water, and it's just
there's no one there to help you if you did.
No, and it's you can get a lift and a hitchhike, but like
rolling the dice there a little bit as well.
Yeah, and just the uncertainty. Whereas like in the rainforest, there's streams everywhere, and there's just so much life and noises and so much color. It makes a huge difference.
That desert landscape, is that just a stretch of road that looks endless? So how does that pretty much?
Yeah, pretty much. There's a photo on my Instagram that the bike's there and it's just flat desert and there's little road going through it. And it's just a flat road and just sand and sand and sand and sand. And there are, like, the villages or the little cities are about 100-120 kilometres distance. And you would, like, you have to make it to that.
Yeah, you have to make it or else you're in a lot of trouble.
Trouble, yeah, because you can't just camp on the side of the road because someone may see you, attack you. So I always made sure I slept in a church, away behind a house, or out of the view of the road, because I always think that someone's not going to attack someone in their own back garden or, like, anywhere in a village. People are going to know people and someone's going to get in trouble. But on the road, someone's like, I could attack her, steal her stuff, get back in the car, and no one's going to know what happened or who it was. So that was,
Did you have any instances where you were, you know, you felt really particularly vulnerable or scared for your personal safety, or
like when I was alone, I was constantly, like, on guard, which is quite exhausting. And you know, when there's a group of men, even if I had someone, like, someone with me at points, if there's a group of men making noises and doing stuff, or you go into a really rough area, because I'm not from those areas, I don't know where the good and bad areas are a lot of the times. So there's a lot of There are a lot of scary moments, but I think just listen to your gut and get out of any situation there where your gut goes,
That's interesting. Yeah, yeah, I've had other guests that have said the same kind of thing, just listening to your intuition.
Yeah, your intuition is, like, a huge indicator. And there's been a few times where I haven't listened to my intuition and I've learned a very valuable lesson, which is to listen to my intuition, because it's there for a reason. It's a weird, like, sixth sense thing.
Yeah, no, it's I think, and it's really heightened when you're traveling. It's uncanny, but you're right. It's there for a reason, and it's very important to listen to it. I did want to talk a little bit about. So you mentioned mental strength. Right, so you talked about, so physically I suppose you're getting stronger. I don't know how this was taking a toll on the body. How many kilometers were you more or less doing per day, or how many hours, I guess, on a typical day would you be on the bike?
Anywhere up to sort of 10-11 hours. At the start I was really, really proud when I did 60 kilometers, and then by the end I was doing it like 130 kilometers a day. So with practice you do get a lot better, and also because I shedded a lot of weight, I got rid of the trailer, I got rid of a lot of weight, so I was able to just cycle faster because I didn't have the weight pulling me back. So on a bad day, like one of the worst days I did was about 12 kilometers. That was in the Andes, and that was at like nearly 5,000 meters above altitude. So I was feeling really altitude sick, and I had a headache, and I just didn't have any motivation. And I was with my fiance at that point, and I was just like, it will stab you if you don't let me stop. And also there were very few places to stop, and we found a place to stop at like half two or something, and that was the first place we'd seen that we could have stopped. So we were like, maybe we'll just stay here. And so we stayed there, and what was your question?
It was about mental strength. I just made an aside around, you know, how the physical side a little bit, but mentally, what was the toughest? What did you have to get through? How did you do it?
Well, my secret is there's like a YouTube channel that I'm addicted to called Motivational Madness, and there's just a ton of videos that just are really motivating. So I have an application on my phone that I can save YouTube videos, and I saved a few of those videos, and I just listened to them when I was really, really down, and they just motivated me to keep going and not give up. And I always say that persistence is the difference between those that make it and those that don't, because you don't have to be great at something, you don't have to be perfect, and you don't have to be the best, you just have to keep going. And because everyone else will drop out, you'll end up being the best person there, because you'll be the last one there, or you'll just get so good at it. So there was a lot of times that I had to dig really, really deep to find motivation, and there are other times that I was just breezing along because it was so sweet and lovely.
The mental side is probably where, for a lot of things, I think the way you put it was beautifully put, because it's that persistence and just keeping just keep going forward, mm-hmm. even if you're going slowly, just keep going forward, and you'll get there. And the mood will change, right? Your mood changes, I suppose. But
in one of the videos, it says, if you quit today, I guarantee you're going to fail. But if you keep going, you don't know what's going to happen. Mm. And so I tell myself that. And I'd go, tomorrow might be the best day of mm-hmm. all. And I'd never know because I finished today. And I'm so glad I didn't give up when I wanted mm-hmm. to, because the best was still yet to come. Mm-hmm. And the end turned out to be the most incredible time with so many lovely people.
So what was that like? You're rolling into Argentina.
How was it like?
Yeah, I mean, so you're talking about the end. And so what was, you know, what was that?
It was really, really funny, because we were speaking to a lady and she said, okay, you go down this road, down that road, you go down a hill and there's the sea. So I gave the camera to my sister and I was like, right, go to the bottom of the hill and film my reaction, because it was a slightly curved hill. So she was like, okay, went to the bottom of the hill, and I was like, right, that's 3 minutes, I'll come up on now. So I'm cycling down there going, woo, like fist pumping in the air, and then I see her, and then I kind of see the sea through these trees, and I see this like bridgey ditch thing with loads of rubbish and a big like fence. And then she said it was hilarious, because I went from this like really joyous to this really puzzled, confused, I can see the sea but I can't get to the sea, and I need to touch the sea, but what's going on? And then so it was a huge anticlimax for the camera,
right?
And then we had to cycle further down and go around, and we ended up getting to it's actually called the River Paraguay, and that's what meets the ocean. Mm-hmm. So we got to this sort of mouth of the mouth of the river, and it started raining. So I literally just ran down, like threw my hand in the water, and then just ran back and was like, right, let's go to a hotel. Like, okay. I don't give a shit about the water. I just want to get to the hotel.
Okay, well, you know, I imagine that I can't imagine how I would have felt, but you know, getting it over with, perhaps in some respects.
Yeah. And I'd love to do like another touring thing again, just with money. Yeah. I would not recommend doing it without money. It's it pushes you to stay in different places. For example, when I was cycling through the Salar de Uyuni, I couldn't pay for a hotel. We mm-hmm. were there. I arrived there. I had to wait there for 3 days for my sister to get there. So I was like, where am I going to stay for 3 days and camp? So then we went to this church, and this guy was like, yeah, I know somewhere that you can stay. Mm-hmm. And he took us to this like salt factory mm-hmm. where these like loads of children were working with mm-hmm. the salt. And it was like, oh, wow. We ended up sleeping in just surrounded by blocks of salt in loads of salt. And it looked like a winter wonderland because it was just white everywhere. But if I had money, I wouldn't have had to have mm-hmm. gone and found that place. So it puts you in a lot more interesting circumstances.
So you didn't you didn't bring any money with you. You didn't have a credit card for backup.
I had a credit card.
Oh, you did. Okay. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Just in case.
Were you tempted to use it?
No.
At any point?
Not really. No. Because I just had this real like, I've got no money. Yeah. Uh-huh. There's no money. And frame of mind. And then I just sort of got used to it, I guess. Mm-hmm. It was from Manta to Lima, I was accepting money.
Mm, okay.
So if people wanted to give me money, I would accept it, but I never spent it because I had the intention to save it and give it to the organization when I got there. But then after Lima, we had to spend that $100 that we'd collected along the way to pay for the bike to be welded back together and fixed.
Right.
And then from Lima, so from the still on the same Pacific coast side, I then decided that I wouldn't touch money whatsoever.
Mm-hmm.
And then as of Lima, I didn't touch money once.
Wow.
When I made that decision to not even touch money, because when I had started to collect bits of money, I started feeling really reassured again that mm-hmm. if I needed to pay for something, I could, because I had this little pot of money there, albeit small, but there was
money.
And
that kind of influences your behavior subtly as well.
A little bit, it was just very reassuring, and I was like, wait, this isn't the motive of my journey.
Yes.
I didn't want this reassurance, I wanted the uncertainty of it. So then from Lima, I vowed not to touch money whatsoever. And I had several people try and give me money. And I was like, no, I'm not touching money. And they were like, oh, how valiant of you, how brave. And I was like, yes, I'm going to regret that in about 2 days. But
what about the kindness of strangers? So I wanted to ask a little bit about that, because other people I've had on my show, and you know, other people who've, I know, you know, who've traveled. One of the wonderful things about travel is when people come up to you and just offer you things and help you for no.
In Paraguay.
Yeah.
In Paraguay, that started. The Mennonite Christians, they just kept stopping and giving us biscuits and treats and drinks and stuff. And it was so lovely to not have to ask. It was so wonderful. Like, so I was so tired of having to ask and being rejected, or having to ask and like someone just giving me something just because they feel obligated to, or something. So it was really lovely just being offered something. The kindness of strangers, I wouldn't have been able to do what I did without it. There were a lot of people that went above and beyond, like, the call of duty, so to say. A lot of people that went completely out of their way, and I know that God's going to have a very special place in heaven for them, because with a heart like that, there's got to be a special place for them. And I also learnt the difference of giving, I learnt the difference between giving and then giving with a smile, because you know, so many times in London there's someone on the street and they've got a little cup and people just throw change into it as they're running around their busy day, and that's great because now he's got a few coins, but it's still that, from, I know what it feels like, that when people just give you, just to give you something, and it makes you feel like a huge burden on society. It made me feel like I was a big burden, and that no one wanted me, and I was unloved, and I was lonely, and no one cared about me, and it made me feel so insecure and scared. But then in Bolivia and Paraguay and Argentina, where people were really smiley and happy to help, it made me feel so special, and it made me feel so loved, and it made me feel like, not important, but it made me feel good. It
made you feel like a human being, right?
Yeah, exactly. It made me feel like a human being again, that I wasn't a burden on society, that I was like a pleasure to be within the world.
Yes, yes. Really great stuff. This is one of the themes of the show, is just around uncertainty and risk and uncertainty. And what did you expect when you started it? Did you have any expectations around it?
I didn't expect it to be easy.
Yeah.
I didn't quite expect so many dirt roads.
Yeah.
But everything has risk involved. And I don't think that you should live your life hiding from risk, because then you're going to have the pain of regret coming later. And that pain of regret is something that influences me very strongly, because you can have the physical pain now, you can have the pain of rejection, you can have the pain of disappointment. There's so many pains that you can have now, but they'll all pass. One pain that you can't reprimand, or is that the right word?
You mean like repair or fix or...
Yeah, it's reprimand. Like, one...
Your vocabulary might be better than mine, so yeah, let's go with that.
Okay, and you might have someone comment later going, one pain that you can't reprimand is the pain of regret. That's something
you carry that with you, don't you?
Until the day you die, just thinking, I wish I'd done that. So, albeit this trip that I just did, I had abundant physical pain, I had emotional pain, I had so much pain of rejection and disappointment, there was all the types of pain that you could imagine, but I'm gonna die a very happy woman, knowing that there's no regret, that I know what it's like. And so that fear of regret is what is probably my driving force for all of this risky business that I do.
Well, that's awesome. That's brilliant. If any of my listeners, you know, they have in their minds something that they'd like to do, maybe they're putting it off, or you know, they're not quite sure, or or somebody who wants to do something not quite like what you've done, but just anything. It could be, you know, starting a new job. It could be whatever. What might you recommend? What would your advice be?
Well, I'd say I've got one saying I live my life by, and it's God give me the strength to change the things I can, the courage to accept the things I cannot, and the wisdom to tell the difference. Mm-hmm. So I always say, if you want to do something, if you can, go and do it. And nothing's impossible until you try. Like, a lot of people say, I don't have the money to go and do it. Well, I've just proved that you don't need money to go and do something. You just need to get there. Or not even that. You can cycle to Africa with no money and then cycle back and try and beg enough money for a ferry or something. You know, there's people use a lot of excuses, and there's no real excuse except they don't really want to, I find. And my advice would be, consider safety a lot. Like, if you're camping, get a lock and lock the inside of your tent, because that stops anyone just like slightly opening it, putting a hand in, or coming into your tent whilst you're sleeping. So that's one of the biggest lessons that I learned, to lock the inside of your tent. If someone wants to attack you and rip open your tent, at least you're going to be awake and it's not a sly attack. So, like, read up about safety and stuff, and don't travel alone. That's there's always safety in numbers. And just don't be afraid. Don't be afraid to risk it for a biscuit, because otherwise you're never going to get the biscuit.
That's great. Great stuff. What now? What now, Laura? What's the next? What's the next thing? What are you thinking about?
Well, I'm getting married in just under 2 months, so that's like the next big thing. I'm like full, like, trying to organize. To help my fiance to organize a wedding from a bike in South America. I know, but now I'm back. He's like, your problem. This is where I'm at now. You can take over. Okay. And I'm like, oh god. And then I'm also trying to write a book. I'm starting to write a book about the whole thing. So, trying to organize the wedding, plan the book, and I've also started planning the next expedition where I'm going on in November, because my fiance goes off to do his expedition in November.
Okay, so you, two adventurers.
Yes.
Yes. Okay. Fabulous.
Yeah, we're both. He's a lot more famous than me, and he's a lot more up the scale than me, so he's like the leading person in the relationship.
Well, you've got the no money thing, course cycling.
He wouldn't have done that. Well, he did for a short patch, but so I'm starting to plan this next one. And
any hints as to what that would involve, or
It's nothing like the cycling, and it's nothing like the sailing.
Okay.
So my whole life is revolved around trying new things.
Yes.
So I'm going to have to brush up on my orientation skills for this next one, because there's no roads.
Okay. So we had, well, water, land, and air, maybe, is it?
No? Maybe. Mm-hmm. That could be an interesting one. Try and invent some, like, duck wings or something and just flap my way across the... but no, I would suggest just following me on Instagram and Twitter.
Fabulous.
to find out more clues.
Where can people find you on social media?
Yeah, they can find me on Instagram and Twitter with Laura Bingham 93, or just on Facebook with Laura Bingham. So there's all platforms covered.
And you've got a website as well.
Yeah, which is laurabingham.org. So
perfect.
All pretty simple. Just my name. You just got to remember my name.
I'm sure everything's all linked together with it as well. Were there any final things that I'd like to wrap it up, because I want to be respectful of your time, but were there any final things that you know, really stood out, or that you felt you think that my listeners would.
I saw a tarantula that was the size of my face.
Really?
And purple. It was purple, and it was just cruising along the road, and I was like, huh, a giant purple tarantula there. And I saw like huge snakes. I saw this little armadillo just like chugging along, and I saw a butterfly that was like the size of my two hands. It was like this giant electric blue butterfly, and I was like,
wow.
Oh, like, just mesmerized by this thing.
Where was the tarantula?
They're all in the Peruvian Amazon.
In the Peruvian Amazon, of course.
That I saw was there. But also the amount of dead animals I saw.
Oh, really?
Literally, pretty much on a daily basis. Well, anywhere that was slightly more populated, the non-populated places, there weren't sort of any. But in the populated places, every 20 meters there'd be a dead dog or a dead cat. Not so many dead cats, but dead dogs.
Yeah,
just a lot of dead dogs.
I I'm imagining that in some of these places, you know, the road, like that's like the only road, and it's probably fairly, you know, fairly trafficked. And as a result, you
I had to kill a chicken.
You did?
Yeah. Uh-huh. Where, I was cycling in Peru. I think a lot of the stories are from Peru because I spent 2 months in there. I was cycling along and there was a chicken and it saw me, panicked, ran the other way, but there was a van coming. So it panicked, saw the van, ran back towards me, saw me again and was like, "Ah, what do I do?" Ran back towards the van and didn't quite make it. And the van came and broke its leg. So I was trying to use one of its legs to claw out of the road and limp. And I was like, well, one, I'm hungry, so I'm going to eat it. And two, I can't leave it there dying. I can't just leave it there to
suffer.
Suffer, yeah. So I got this rock and I was like squeaking and like, no, I don't want to. But I like got this rock and just smashed its head in. And this is about 11 o'clock. So I put the chicken on the back of the trailer and covered it with water and put my hat over it to keep it cool so it didn't go bad because I didn't want it to go bad and to go to waste. And then, ate the chicken for dinner at the end of the day and had to like gut it and pluck it and... but at least it didn't go to waste.
There you go.
I ate so much food on the side of the road.
You were on a paleo primal diet for a little while. We're in London and I, you know, took the tube to work today and, you know, it's just like, you know, it's a different world. Plus I'm a vegan, so I don't eat meat. But I'm sure in those circumstances I probably would have.
I ate guts.
Everything.
Everything and anything. The least enjoyable thing is a chicken's neck. Yeah, because that's pure gristle, muscle, nasty. Yeah. But
it's
protein.
It's protein.
It's protein. I'm a carnivore.
No other. You didn't eat any grubs and other.
I ate a
crazy
lot of maggots by accident.
Oh, did you?
The guavas.
Yeah.
I'd be like, "Oh, guavas! Eat them." Yeah. And I'd be like, "Ooh."
It's also protein.
That's what a lot of people said on the. I've got a YouTube video as well where
I saw the potatoes that had
potatoes.
All the
potatoes. And when the maggots are cooked, they kind of go flat and weird, and it was just really, really funny. I liked that, but she was a lovely lady.
she seemed like a lovely lady. I'm sure that you had, you know, a lot of people like that along the way, but maggot infested potatoes. But you also probably saw some beautiful things as well, in addition to the scenery and
I think the Ecuadorian Andes and the Peruvian rainforest were the most beautiful landscapes. Not the nicest place with no money. I'd say those places with money would be quite enjoyable, but with no money, not so much.
Yeah.
I probably stick to Argentina and Paraguay with the slightly less beautiful landscapes, but the nicer people.
Yeah, okay. Right. Well, I wanted to wrap it up, but this was great. I really enjoyed this. I wanted to thank you for coming by, and I'm sure my listeners are going to check out all of your videos and are going to keep a keen eye on what happens next.
Yeah, but, we've got some exciting adventures coming up.
Looking
so
forward
to
following. Yeah,
following.
Laura, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
I hope you enjoyed that. I certainly did. Incidentally, Laura's fiance is Ed Stafford, who is a famous explorer and a Discovery Channel presenter. So both together are going to be an adventurer power couple, which should be fun. I wish them all the best on their wedding. And if you're interested in Laura's next adventure, check out her social media. I know what the next adventure is, but I've been sworn to secrecy. Just a few final thoughts. The first was around regret, and I just wanted to reiterate this, that look, regret is something that you carry with you, and I thought that Laura expressed all of that very eloquently. So if there's something you really want to do, just find a way to do it. Which brings me on to the second point, which is look, this no money thing really still boggles my mind. And I guess the whole second point is that there are no excuses. You can do something fairly epic with little, in fact, no money, as Laura showed. And it doesn't have to be money. It could be anything else. It could be timing. It could be your age, whatever you might be using as a potential excuse to put something off. Maybe rethink that, because that thing might not be an obstacle after all. You might be able to find a way to do it. The third thing, and it's something that all of my guests have said in one shape or form, and that's around planning. That doing something epic, it doesn't have to be epic. It could be just something that you really want to do. It does require some planning. It does require being prepared organizationally and mentally. It doesn't mean being reckless. It doesn't mean dropping everything, shirking all of your responsibilities all at once and going off and doing something. Planning and being prepared and at least thinking through how things are going to work is very important. And, you know, once again, I think that Laura's tale really underscores that. And the last thought was around the kindness of strangers. Laura clearly couldn't have done what she did without relying on strangers to be there to provide food, shelter, whatever. And I think it's important for us to think about that and to try to pay that forward as well. So be kind to someone you don't know. You don't know what is going through someone's mind, how they might be struggling or not. It's just a good thing to do. And I think the world is a better place if we all play that part. So a very important lesson. So those are my final thoughts. I hope you enjoyed the episode once again. We will be back next week with more. In the interim, do check out my website, allthingsrisk.com. Give me a follow on Twitter, @riskthings is the handle. And if you have any feedback, I would love to hear from you. allthingsrisk@gmail.com is the best place to do that. I would love to hear from you. That's it. We'll be back soon. Don't forget, risk is life.